Good morning. When we gather and live on original lands of Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. These are historic facts. For my part, my desire is to live in a way that demonstrates full respect for the treaties that were made on these territories. I wish to live in ways that acknowledge the harms and the mistakes of the past. And I personally dedicate myself to moving forward in partnership with Indigenous people, Indigenous groups, and communities in the spirit of reconciliation and collaboration, and I would say kinship. I'm not going to expand on that this morning. I think there's plenty there to work with, you know? Let's take a few moments to breathe together. Zach and Cheryl both reminding us this morning already of the importance of stillness, of just stopping sometimes. If you grew up around Sabbath concepts at all, the word Sabbath at its most sort of rudimentary level or foundational level might be a better way to say it, simply means stop. The importance of stop. It's huge. So, let's stop for a few moments and breathe together. And we'll just do the simplest practice that we do in our community, just square breathing in through our nose for a count of three, cradle your breath for a count of three, out for a count of six. And we'll do four rounds of that. Just calm our bodies, our minds, gather ourselves consciously into the same space, and then we will carry on. All right? Again, an invitation to participate or not, as you are inclined or able, and to pick this up if it's for you. Only you can know that. So let's breathe together. Thank you. I realize that in ways that are unavoidably the case, we all breathe as individuals. I can't breathe for you, you can't breathe for me. Those are, let's say, the material facts of the matter. We might be able to share some other aspects of biological life with one another, so we can give blood, we could donate a kidney, you know, that sort of thing. And even if we choose to do so, we could have our heart be transplanted into someone else when it no longer serves us. We can share breath with one another only temporarily. Otherwise, that's a thing we can't share. And yet, and this is where we bump straight into mystery, the way that I breathe has an impact on the way that you breathe. If I'm tense, if I'm wound up tight, if I'm, you know, holding my breath, as it were, and I have any proximity to you, study after study shows that there are ways in which that rubs off, so to speak. We say things about, you know, challenging work meetings, maybe, like the room felt tense. What? I mean, I guess we mean, you know, not the room physically, obviously. There were a lot of tense people in the room. Like, how does this stuff travel? Well, that illustration is, you know, from before times when people were in the same room for meetings. So how does this work now, with there so often being so much more physical space between us? Does the mystery of how I'm doing, how my body, how my mind, how my spirit are doing, affect those around me? I was reading an article recently about the strange dynamics of a federal election in the midst of a pandemic, in which the author Shannon Proudfoot cited an online focus group that was conducted by the polling company Ipsos to try to get a handle on what Canadians were feeling in this time. And I want to read you a little bit of her summary of sort of the vibe of that polling group, which was six Canadians from across the country. So an attempt to kind of represent a cross section of Canadians. This is what she wrote. The participants mentioned the tiniest of joys that fed their souls right now. One saw her best friend for the first time in 2 years. Two others learned that online gatherings with loved ones at holidays are awkward, but could be real sources of happiness and connection. Some were grateful the pandemic had pared their life down to what they now understood were the only things that matter. But there was an obvious sadness there. You only recognize the essentials when you've lost so much already. What the group described over and over was a narrowing of their field of vision. What they had capacity to care about, what they could muster energy for, what they could find a spirit of generosity for, and the time frame in which they knew what to expect or could plan something to look forward to had shrunken to a tiny porthole of protective selfishness and immediacy. They all seemed troubled by that creeping smallness, but how could it be any other way? Anybody resonate with that? Anybody else feel like there's this sort of collection of things pushing on them that are adding up over time to something like what Proudfoot talks about this focus group describing? It's another perspective on that. There's a writer, I've just started to be aware of this this person and their work, author named Ali Brosh. Brosh is the creator of a rather strange, often quite brilliant web comic called Hyperbole and a Half. I find that even that name funny and witty. Who needs more hyperbole than hyperbole already delivers? Anyway, Hyperbole and a Half. And she has their web comics, like I said, with so there's sort of the panel and then there's blocks of text, is sort of the way it's laid out physically. Anyway, she has one called The Sneaky Hate Spiral. And it's about how, as regular adults just going about our ordinary business, we sometimes get pushed into pretty much like toddler level tantrum meltdowns. You can look it up for yourself if you just search Hyperbole and a Half, you'll find it. And it's worth doing, if only to see her first rudimentary appearing line drawings. They almost look crude, artistically speaking. But they often, in my experience at least, they kind of shortcut cuteness and they get right at emotions. Like they just go straight to the feeling part of things. In any case, what she's dissecting in this particular strip is this sneaky hate spiral. And she introduces the concept this way. She writes, "Sneaky hate spirals begin simply enough. That's one of the hallmarks. They are merely the confluence of many unremarkable annoyances." And then she goes on to offer some examples. So in the drawings, you can sort of see her. She's still in bed and she gets assaulted by the neighbor's car alarm and then by the cat and then by the alarm clock playing La Bamba. And then as the day goes along, this stuff just piles up. There's a lost wallet. There's a bag of chips that resists being opened until it finally opens only to burst all over the floor. And then, of course, the radio again playing La Bamba. And she writes this, "The little frustrations start to happen more quickly. They ping against your psyche like hundreds of tiny pebbles." Ah. And eventually, she brings us to the turning point where this sort of accumulated mass of irritants tips us over into like full-blown and she writes about it this way, about the turning point. She says, "The turning point is usually a minor but slightly jarring incident initiated by some force of nature that cannot be blamed or scolded, like gravity or sleeplessness or wind, in order to send you into truly bat bleep," Family Show, right? "Bat bleep crazy hysterics. The final straw must cause anger that cannot rationally be directed outward in any way." And then her character ends the strip screaming at the sky and at a bird that has offended her by repeatedly proclaiming its birdness. Maybe it's because I've seen the drawings as well, but I can feel a bit of a sort of bubble of empathy inside of me, even as I retell the story, right alongside to the bubble of pending meltdown. You know, like this could happen. I could feel the accumulation of those kind of things that Brosh describes. And then right along with those feelings, the thought that maybe it's moments like this that are the reason that as human beings, we come up with notions about mystery that give it a name, that give it a personality, that give it a story. I think we're hardwired to give a name to it, to make meaning of the things that happen around us and to us. And I think that as human beings, we're going to do that one way or another. And one of the ways we often do it as a species is by personifying the mystery, by naming what we don't know, which is what mystery is, right? And we're not going to get into this today, but one of the curious things about how our brains work is that we tend to care the most, sometimes even almost care only about things we personify. Do you ever wonder why clearly mechanical objects like cars or boats sometimes get named, boats maybe especially for some reason, perhaps most noteworthily named as females by, emotionally stunted males? That's highly editorial. Here's the science part. If we personify something, our brains tell us it's okay to care about it, to love it, to sacrifice for it, to encourage, maybe to even assume or insist that others care as well. That's how we're wired. Now, that might be a bit of a shallow or to some, maybe even a negative illustration. Maybe it's a bit funny if you're distant from it. Maybe it's not so funny if you've ever felt like you were playing second fiddle to a car or a house in a relationship. So, of course, if we do it with inconsequential things like cars and boats, of course we do this when it comes to concepts we might call God as well. We personify mystery. In the case of the Christian religion in particular, there's sort of a significant additional layer to this. Not only do we have the ancient, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, not only do we have the ancient Hebrew personifications, which in the early going in the text as we have them include many gods. Sometimes Christian tradition likes to ignore that, but it's all there in Christianity's library. And then eventually, the makers of those stories borrow the notion of God as one from the Egyptians. And that concept eventually evolves through those stories into the more common Middle Ages idea of Trinity, of three yet one, that some of us might be familiar with. And if we took that idea of Trinity just in terms of language for a moment, Father, Son, and then, Holy Spirit. So we're going to personify this, but we're going to kind of keep mystery in the basket with the personification. Interesting, right? And then, of course, there's also the particular character of Jesus, an actual historic figure, this Jewish rabbi whose teachings so galvanized a group of first century Jews that they grew a religion up around him and those teachings. Now, that religion, like most religions, has a lot of different iterations, many of which are clearly complicit in actions that, from where I sit at least, cannot possibly be manipulated into alignment with the teachings of the rabbi himself, whose core ideas have as their indisputable anchor point the teaching, love one another, because whatever else you're naming when you name the divine, it's love. The divine is love. And again, for another day, maybe in more depth, but that love, when Jesus talks about it, is a love that fully animates our humanity, that fully animated, in Jesus' own understanding of himself, fully animated his humanity, and that we could all be a part of. Be one with the Father like I'm one with the Father. That's what Jesus is talking about. Be one with love like I'm one with love. The personification we do as humans. Sometimes all those different notions about mystery, about the divine, about God, can behave more like the parts of a crazy-making day than like a lodestar by which we might orient our lives. They can start to ping against our psyches like so many tiny pebbles. They can make our focus smaller and smaller until our view of the world is one from, and I love this sentence of Proudfoot's, is one from a tiny porthole of protective selfishness and immediacy. And then comes the jarring incident, initiated by some force that cannot be blamed or scolded. Maybe it's gravity, or sleeplessness, or the wind. Maybe it's a pandemic. Maybe it's a global circumstance that increasingly feels less like an event or a crisis and more like a defining era. Either way, it's the sort of thing that can cause anger that cannot be rationally directed outward. Which, as an aside, maybe is partly why attempts to rationally direct that anger outward often appear radically irrational, even when there might be significant thought behind them. In any case, these sorts of things can accumulate, and they can feel like they're pressing us toward a smaller and smaller view of the world. And that, as we may be increasingly aware by our own personal experience, is not the kind of space in which we might feel equipped or motivated to explore what we believe. It can even feel like a space that mocks that kind of an endeavor, that chides us for being too naive or too earnest to be believable. I find it fascinating that the emerging data on how this moment in history is impacting us collectively illustrates some clearly divergent trends. On the one hand, we can see a growing inclination toward moving cautiously through life. Because, hey, you never know when the next pandemic might strike or if this one will ever end. So that's us, in terms of a maybe a little wider view of history. That's us behaving like the people that survived the Depression by saving up soap bars from hotel rooms when we travel, just in case that's the next thing there's a shortage of. So that's one kind of big kind of way to group some trends behaviorally. And on the other hand, the other divergent group of trends is this clearly measurable one that looks more like, hey, you only live once, so go for it. And that is justified with, hey, you never know when the next pandemic will strike or if this one will ever end. Same justification, different behavior. And some days, don't we just sort of vacillate back and forth between those poles depending on our circumstance or our inclination or what we're trying to justify? Maybe we're even consciously attempting to find something like balance or peace or hope in the middle of it all. With that in mind, let's take a moment to imagine that porthole that I mentioned a moment ago. I'm not sure, given that we're in the middle of the prairies and all, I'm not sure how many of us have even had occasion to look through a porthole. But if you haven't, if you have, you already have a picture in your mind probably. But if you haven't, just imagine a small, round, deep window that is surrounded by a solid, impervious wall. And the only way, under those circumstances, you can see the world on the other side of the wall is through that window. Now, one of the practical aspects of this is that the further you stand away from the porthole, the less you see of the world. That's just the way the physics of it work, the material dynamics of it work. The widest view is not from far away. The widest view is from right up against the glass. Right up against the glass of our limited view of the world is where our exploration of faith and doubt brings us, if we will let it. It moves us closer to the widest possible view. Doesn't make our limitations go away. It doesn't help us see everything. It doesn't replace mystery with irrefutable truth claims that delineate a comprehensive, encompassing description of the wide-changing and ever-expanding world beyond the glass. But it can move us closer, helping us see something wider than we would if we held back, perhaps for fear of what we might see if we lean in, or maybe because we prefer the view we already have. Or maybe we just don't feel ready to face whatever looking closer might reveal. In any case, the opportunity is there. And stage four tends to be when we start to feel more and more strongly that getting the best look we can might be startling, might be disconcerting, might even be life-altering, but holding back from that kind of exploring while also claiming to know what's actually out there might be starting to feel more and more disingenuous to us all the time, and we're taking steps to change that. That's sort of a big end of the funnel of stage four. And if you don't know what I'm talking about when I suddenly drop stage four language into the conversation, then I suggest you go back and listen to at least a couple of the podcasts from the I Doubt It series, which shameless plug, you can find on our website at thetablewinnipeg.com or anywhere else pretty much you get your podcasts. I want to sort of spend the last little bit of our time together here on a description of the first few characteristics of folks in stage four. And as always, a reminder that this isn't a description of something exhaustive. It's also not a description of something sequential. It's iterative as well as building on each stage, building on the other. If we look at things like faith and doubt through lenses like this kind of schema that we've been using, we'll find ourselves and others in many or maybe even all of them at the same time. And that said, we may also find that we strongly identify with one stage or the other more than the others. And that can sometimes help us to make sense of our own journey. It can also help us to have a little more understanding and empathy for other people's journeys and where they're at. So, and I think those things both matter. I think it's important for us to kind of go, oh, I hadn't thought about my own experiences in that light before, and to have a framework for them. Again, putting language and story around our experiences, right? And similar for other people, where if we have a framework for this stuff, sometimes it can kind of give us an entry point where we go, oh, you know, if I think about that person's experience in terms of the things that we all learn in stage one, black and white learning, and I think, yeah, that sort of seems to be the stage they're at in this particular aspect of their life, that might help me go, oh, okay, sure, with that lens, I can appreciate how the world would look that way. And it just gives us that entry point, right, for dialogue and for empathy. Anyway, let's start in the same place that we have with all the other stages. And that is in terms of the grid, and that is with our perception of the whole. So in each of these other stages, what we've sort of done is worked our way through a series of descriptors. If you scroll far enough down in our Facebook feed, you'll find a chart that has some of those on it. And eventually we'll post one that has all four stages outlined this way. But the first category in there is perception. So how do we perceive the whole, if you will, in a particular stage? Just a little refresher, just to kind of get us into what we're comparing here. So in stage one, our perception was dominated by dualism. We tended to look at the world primarily through the lens of either or. In stage two, our 30,000 foot view of the world was mostly pragmatic. What works for me? And who are the other folks that see it that way? So if that's the winning view of the world for me, who are the other winners so we can get together and be winners together? That's sort of stage two, sort of self-interested pragmatism. And then in stage three, our perception was mostly informed by a critical or relativistic view of things, sort of who's being disingenuous, what's being kept hidden here, what needs to be deconstructed if I'm going to have an honest view of the world and of my place in it and of my faith and belief and so on and so forth, right? So that's stage three. In stage four, that same sort of category of what's our overarching view of things is that we are make our way to, have the experience of an integrative or holistic perception. We're seeking a world in which everything belongs. And because that's what we're exploring in this stage, our focus tends to be on things like inclusion and transcendence. It tends to be on inclusion, informed by ideals like equality and equity, ideas like acceptance and embrace, ideas like common good or greater good. Our perspective is informed by transcendence as well. Now, that's not quite as common a word as inclusion these days, is it? Inclusion gets used lots. We have inclusion committees, you know. Maybe one of the reasons why the word transcendence is not quite as common as inclusion is related to that tiny porthole of protective selfishness and immediacy. Let me see if I can kind of connect those dots a little bit. Maybe because of the myriad ways in which those hundreds of pebbles pinging against our psyche, the gathering of ordinary things under extraordinary circumstances pressing in against our sense of well-being, maybe that's what makes that porthole happen in the first place, that shrinking view, that view of the world that's primarily about me and mine. Maybe choosing to explore what we believe can help us, instead of backing away from the porthole so that our view gets narrower and narrower of the world, more and more about selfishness and immediacy. Maybe leaning in, which we tend to talk about here at the table as exploring what we believe, those are the same thing. Maybe choosing to explore what we believe can help us move toward a wider view. Maybe it can help us through this very season and the things about it that might otherwise back us away from that same challenge. In that spirit, just a couple of thoughts about the importance of transcendence to sort of send us on our way this particular time. The word itself is a two-parter. Part one, trans, so transcendence. Part one, trans, comes from a Latin prefix that means beyond. Hence, in our use of English, the application of that word to ideas, for example, about gender and sexuality by people that don't find themselves fitting the dominant understanding of those definitions, beyond those definitions, right? We could also see it, I can see it in lots of places, but it's also a very pragmatic word that shows up in common language, like a word like transported, right? Moving things beyond the port where they're in to another place, beyond their ordinary previous place. So that's trans. Part two of transcendence is from the Latin again, scandare, which means to climb. And so the word itself points us toward this notion of climbing or moving beyond the ordinary or beyond the customary, beyond the familiar. So no wonder we often use it when we're trying to describe spiritual experiences or spiritual longings, longing for transcendence. As I was writing this, I found myself wondering if our definition of what is transcendent might be shrinking quite a lot these days, sort of in conjunction with the ways our definitions of ordinary feel like they're getting smaller or closing in on us. So if to transcend has as part of its meaning to sort of climb beyond the ordinary, if the ordinary is getting smaller, climbing beyond it might not take us as far as it once did, if that makes sense. So I was just, I'm not, maybe something to keep an eye on. Anyway, in stage four, we are looking for transcendence. That's not exclusive to this stage, of course. We could probably make a case for the longing for transcendence being a pretty basic human longing, this longing to rise above the ordinary in some way, especially if the ordinary feels like it's pressing us down. Here's what I want to leave us to muse about. What if those two ideas, the ideas surrounding inclusion and the ideas surrounding transcendence, what if they are at their best when they are interlocked? What if inclusion and transcendence are sort of symbiotic, that they both feed on and care for one another? What if love one another is the path to transcendence? To view it from the other side, if you will, what if exclusion or othering makes transcendence that much more difficult to engage with or even to recognize when we're surrounded by it? What if exclusion backs us away from the porthole of the widest possible view we can have of the world? And what if that backing away and that narrowing view makes transcendence that much more difficult to experience or explore? Would that make inclusion worth working for? Even as the world around us seems bent on devolving into adamant disagreements, partisan bickering, and intransigent positioning? I'm going to leave that as an open question. Would the possibility that the interlocking or symbiotic relationship between inclusion and transcendence, providing more ready access or more possibilities of the exact thing we're longing for spiritually and in our lives in many ways, What if the interlocking of those two things is what makes them more likely and more possible? And behaving differently than that, exclusion rather than inclusion, reduces the opportunities, awareness, sensitivity to possibilities for transcendence. Would that make inclusion worth working for? Well, like I said, an open question. Let it perk. We'll pick up next week exploring the question of motivation, because that's sort of next in the grid. Sort of addressing ourselves to what might keep us going on a project like the seeking of things like inclusion and transcendence, seeking of the ways to live in a world where everything belongs, even when that going gets difficult. That's where we'll be headed next week. So we can look forward to that. Thanks for joining in. And if you're catching this later in the week, either by podcast or here on the Facebook stream, thanks for making the time. Thanks for musing together. I think this is another way of breathing together, if you will. It's the breath of the mind, the breath of the spirit, not just the breath of the body. And when we breathe together, when we think together about these things, and we reflect on them, we hold them in our hearts, they inform a common way of living, of being in the world, that can underpin the best kind of inclusion, and again, the possibility of transcendence, right? And that's, I think, would be a good thing. We could use a little transcending the ordinary anytime, and maybe especially in this time. Peace, everybody. It's been good to be with you, and I look forward to seeing some of you in person in the not too distant future. Bye for now.